morning we've got Dr. Benjamin Habib. He's a lecturer here in the Faculty of Humanities and Social Sciences. Am I right there?
Yep.
And he actually teaches politics and international relations.
Yep.
Is that right?
Yep.
I'll let Ben talk to you and introduce himself. And we'll hear what Ben's got to say, because this is his area. Ben, over to you.
Thank you. Thanks, Martha, and thanks for inviting me to come and speak to this group. I'm really excited to be here. I've done a number of talks like this at high schools and with other groups of university students at other places. So it's nice to be able to contribute to your program, and hopefully you get something positive out of today. Just a quick introduction about where I'm coming from. International relations is my specialty area, and particularly Northeast Asia. So my main research focus is on all things North Korea, particularly nuclear weapons and climate change impacts in that country and the political stability of the Kim regime. I've got extensive in-country experience in the region. It all started when I did a second year undergraduate exchange to South Korea in 2002, which was a life-changing experience for me. So if any of you get a chance to do an exchange in your program here, I thoroughly recommend it, especially in the context of what we're talking about today. I've also spent a lot of time in China, Taiwan, and a bit in Southeast Asia and India as well. And I'm learning Mandarin as we speak, so you can never stop learning. And as aspiring teachers, I'm sure that's something that you'll be pumping to your students in the future when you're on this side of the desk. What I'm going to do today is... This lecture will hopefully be very interactive. So my style is pretty informal. I like to ask a lot of questions of you. So get ready to fire up and contribute to the class. We're drawing on the collective wisdom of the group, not just me standing up here and talking for an hour. I'm going to start out by introducing a few key ideas that underpin how I see Australian-Asian relations. Then I'll look at some of the history of Australia's interactions with Asia, some of it positive, some of it negative, but it's important that we embrace that history in its totality so we can move forward constructively. Then I'll look at some of the links that exist today, be they economic, cultural, political, etc. And then I'll look at some of the skills that you'll develop through studying or through cross-cultural study and learning about Asia and Australia's relations with it. At the end of each of those phases, I'm going to ask you guys sort of a fundamental question about how what I've just said applies to you professionally. So in each of those cases, I'll give you a minute or two just to chat with the partner next to you, discussing that question, then we'll wrap about it as a group. So let's move on. Okay, so starting off with three or four big picture concepts that underpin where I'm coming from. The picture you see there is a scanned copy of one of my visas for entering the People's Republic of China. So if you ever go there, you'll get something like that in your passport. First, something that's pretty obvious when you look at a map is that Australia can't escape its geography. Geographically, apart from ocean, our closest neighbours are in the Asian region. And now I've taken this image from Google Earth to really illustrate that point. So sometimes it's good to look at maps from a different orientation than the one that maps are usually, the north-south view that maps are usually presented in. And this really illustrates the fact that I'm talking about there. Secondly, although we're throwing around the word Asia pretty liberally in this class, there's really no such thing as Asia. Now, why might that be? Why might I make a claim like that?
To define it as one thing is too broad and sweeping.
Would you say that about Europe?
Yeah.
You probably shouldn't.
Yeah.
You wouldn't say that about Africa. You wouldn't say that about South America. Although there are some common characteristics, what we see in this region is vast ethnic, cultural, religious diversity. Koreans are very different from Chinese, who are very different from Japanese, who are very different from Vietnamese, who are very different from Indonesians, etc., etc. Even if we look at a country like China or like Indonesia, these are places that have numerous ethnic groups living within them. In China, for example, there's 56 official ethnic minorities acknowledged by the Chinese government. So this is a very diverse region, and a lot of Australians who haven't had much experience dealing with this region make the mistake of assuming that Asians are all the same, which is ridiculous, frankly. And the third major point I'd like to make is that everyone on the planet now exists as part of a globalised world. So this graphic is a picture of friend connections through Facebook. It's a bit old now, and there's probably more connections than when this graphic was made a few years ago. But this illustrates that we live in an interconnected world, and it's not possible to try and separate yourself from other regions. So people who approach international relations from a xenophobic point of view, like some people we have in our society and some people in all societies are a bit xenophobic, kind of defies reality. We live in an interconnected world, and that you can't escape this. So the best way to constructively deal with this is to learn about the world around you, and that's what we're going to do today. The next thing I'm going to talk about is the burden of history. The history of Australia's relationships with the Asian region. Now, if we look at that over the span of 200 plus years of Australian history, some of it's positive, a lot of it's not. And we really have to be honest about the negative parts of this relationship, because people outside of Australia still look at Australia through the lens of this negative history. So if we don't understand that, we can't understand how other people look at us. Now, Australia, even pre-settlement, pre-European settlement, has a history of long links with the Asian region. So if we look at this indigenous picture here, this depicts trade between Makassan Chipang hunters from the Indonesian archipelago, I think from the Maluku Islands, who would regularly, every season, come down to northern Australia and hunt for trepangs, which are sea sponges of a kind. And they would interact with the Aboriginal people who lived in the top end. And so those people living in the top end were integrated into what was an international trade network that spanned almost the entire South China Sea, right up into southern China. That's very good evidence that Australia was integrated into international trade even before white settlement. If we look at the black and white picture on the bottom, this is a graphic from when, do you think? Yes, this is the gold rush, somewhere in one of the gold fields in Victoria. I can't remember where exactly. What do you notice about the people in there? There are. There was a very rich heritage of Chinese immigration to Australia during the Gold Rush period. Now, one of the reasons for that was the fact that there was gold there, and there was a great attraction for people all around the world to come to Australia and to California at the same time, for the same reason, to try and get rich in the gold fields. Also, what is less known in Australia is that in southern China at the time, there was a thing going on called the Taiping Rebellion, which is the largest civil war in history, where 30 million people died. So there's an obvious reason for Chinese living in that area to escape China and look for a better life elsewhere, including here in Victoria. The lady on the left, her name is Professor My Van Tran. She was the first Vietnamese person to be granted citizenship in Australia. And she was also one of my teachers when I was doing my undergraduate degree at the University of South Australia, and she's a lovely lady. And she was brought to Australia under something called the Colombo Plan, which was a plan by the Australian government to bring people from across the Asian region to study in Australia and to start to break down some of the stone walls that had developed during the White Australia period. Now, the reason I brought up the fact that Australia can't get around its geography is because for a large portion of Australian history, the dominant Anglo culture has tried to do precisely that, tried to quarantine itself from the fact that Australia exists in the Asian region. And you can see that in a lot of the stereotypes that existed at the time. So this picture here, who's it depicting? Yes, so this comes from the late 19th century, so the Gold Rush era, where you had Chinese miners competing on the diggings with Australian miners and miners from elsewhere around the world. The labour movement was very much against Chinese immigration at the time. So you get these stereotypes. This was not something that was uncommon throughout the British Empire in the late 19th century. There's quite a bit of cultural chauvinism, as you can see from this graphic. Who's being demonised in this picture? If you know anything about the Catholic-Protestant divide?
Sorry?
Yes. So, Catholics and Irish being demonised here. And why? Because the British Empire was a predominantly Protestant institution. And up here you see a depiction of an Asian Japanese geisha type person here and an Aboriginal woman walking the street, both of which are stereotypes of prostitution and decrepitude, which was the dominant popular understanding of people from these ethnic groups among the dominant culture here in Australia for a long time. So these are the kinds of stereotypes that thankfully Australia is weaning away from, but old cultural habits die hard. The greatest institutional expression of these themes was the White Australia policy. This was the first act of the new Federated Parliament in 1901, was to introduce the White Australia policy. Now, what do you know about it? Let's throw out some thoughts. Yep. Yep,
you were going to say it was racist.
Yeah, clearly discriminating who could enter the country on the basis of their racial origin. Northern Europeans were privileged. For me, my surname is Lebanese, so people who came to Australia around the turn of the 19th, 20th century of Lebanese extraction tried really hard to present themselves as Europeans and distinguish themselves from people from China or India or elsewhere who were not European. So my family history is part of this, and a lot of yours will be as well. When did this finish? When was it repealed?
60s.
Yeah.
70s.
Yeah. It was just before Whitlam came into power. Can't remember the exact date, but late 60s, early 70s. Now, I said that old habits die hard. There are still pockets of this kind of thinking that persist in our society today. So any guess as to what this incident's depicting here?
The Cronulla riots.
Yeah, the Cronulla riots. What about down here in the bottom? This is something very local and recent. Yeah. So yes, this is racial abuse on Melbourne public transport. And thankfully people are now videotaping these incidents and putting them on YouTube to shame them because it's not acceptable. What about this? Yes. Yeah, so this is the Children Overboard incident, the CIVX, where the Australian government claimed that people who were on this boat that was on fire were throwing their children overboard so that the military would have to come and pick them up and therefore they'd have to be taken back to Australia for processing. The truth was, as you can see, the boat was on fire and everyone was jumping out, otherwise they would die. And of course we know the lady in the top right corner, don't we? Yeah, and we might see a resurgence of people like that in the new parliament with some of the micro parties in the Senate who have some persuasions of that nature. So when people outside of Australia see things like this occurring today, based on the history, the darker history of Australia's interactions with Asia, they assume that this is how it is, how we are as a rule. So it's very hard for Australia to try and integrate itself into the region when this stereotype persists, which is why it's really important for people like you to learn about various Asian cultures and to interact constructively so we can destroy this stereotype. So with that in mind, just for a couple of minutes, discuss with someone next to you why this history is relevant to you, personally and professionally. Okay. Any thoughts? Who wants to share? Yep.
Well, we're talking about just us as teachers, that's sort of fairly standard, but you think about wanting to travel overseas, that before you're trying to immerse yourself in someone else's cultural identity, you're trying to defend your own by going, hey, we've come a long way and not everyone is like that, and the majority of us aren't. So you're spending sort of the first portion of going overseas and trying to experience other cultural identities, and you're spending most of that time going, hey, I'm Australian, but I'm not racist, and I just want to be a part of your culture, and people are obviously standoffish on that sort of view.
Is this something you've got personal experience with?
Yeah.
Where? How about?
Going over to Vanuatu, I just come back, and it was fine in the villages, everyone's really friendly, but as soon as you get into the city, you've got a lot of, like New Caledonia as well, they've got a lot of French expats that are really standoffish to Australians, because they're a little bit further removed from the tourism industry, and they're just like, yeah, we don't really want to know you.
Yeah, that's a really interesting case, because of course in the South Pacific...
They're normally really friendly.
Yeah, but Australia is seen as like the superpower of the South Pacific.
Yeah, so it's more the expats that they have problems with, so...
Yeah, yeah. So again, you're right, that history, you do have to deal with that sometimes. Now, it would really suck to be an American at the moment in the world, and I know when I've travelled with Americans, they find it really grueling having to justify, you know, what their government's doing in places like Iraq and Afghanistan, and particularly in the Bush era. That was more of an issue. But yeah, I do feel for my American friends, have to go through that process. Mm. Any other thoughts? Yep.
I'm heading over to Canberra again at the end of the year to teach. And I've just been reading a few articles and stuff that, like, when you're in the heart of the town, not to actually fully dramatise the fact that you're Australian. Like, I can't remember what they were saying, but one of the people who had previously been over there was saying that, you know, when you're in the marketplace, to just sort of keep to yourself sort of thing. You don't want to advertise that you're Australian and you're not initially from here, because that's, you know, it brings attention to yourself for, like, pickpocketing and arguments and, you know, stuff like that. Whereas, you know, like, out in the villages and stuff, generally they love Australians. So it's just... there's just certain things to be aware of that, you know, you wouldn't generally think about, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. And look, Australians do have a reputation abroad in some quarters for drunken cultural insensitivity when we travel. Now, we've all been there from time to time, but self-awareness that can be problematic when you're doing that kind of thing and insulting to other cultures is good to have. Now, I've learnt my lesson in that regard, as you all will at some point, yeah.
Just thinking on a more local level, I'm originally from New Zealand, but I've always been very aware of where my family has come from, which is a lot of countries around Europe, UK. I'm a real mixture. I've always been very aware of that, not really had an understanding of people who have come here and established that this is their place and they should exclude a whole lot of other people. And so it's always been on my mind that, especially in a place like Melbourne, where there are so many communities of other cultures, and particularly Asia, I personally would like to be able to relate to that on a more personal level, whether it's language or whatever. So I try and do that on some levels, and I'd like to take it to the next level with language. But yeah, I just feel that as a community of this country, which is made up of so many different people, as a citizen, you know, of this country, I almost feel like it's my responsibility to do something like that. and yeah, exist yeah. in some kind of make-believe structured microcosm.
Yeah, that's a good point. And the reality of Australian society is that it's multicultural. That's just the facts on the ground. So a lot of these xenophobic views are trying to quarantine white Australia from this horde coming from elsewhere. That's not the reality on the ground. This is a multicultural place, and it's a great idea to want to be part of that. Society's better when people try and constructively engage with people from other cultures. And in Melbourne's a great place to do that. It's a very cosmopolitan city. Now, I spent the last 3 years working at La Trobe's Albury Wodonga campus, which is in one of the more conservative areas of Australia. And it's not necessarily the fault of the people there that they have more regressive views on the stuff that we're talking about, because people who would generally try and challenge those views, people like you guys, for example, have to move away for educational or employment experience. So the people who would offer different perspectives in those places leave. So you get this artificial creation or continuation of conservative social values. But many of you will probably be posted to country areas in your teaching career, so you'll come up against this kind of prejudice from time to time. All right, let's have a look now at some of the existing connections between Australia and Asia. And now we're getting a bit more practical, so we're moving on from history. We're looking at these interactions as they are now. And cultural ties are pretty obvious. There's tons of examples here. I guess the best example of cultural integration between Australia and the Asian region now is football. So this is a picture I took in 2008. I'm from Adelaide and I follow Adelaide United in the A-League, and they made the Asian Champions League final. And this is our home game in that fixture in Adelaide. So that's a great example of where Australia is actively and is considered part of Asia now. But there's cultural ties that are very strong. We've got numerous diaspora communities in Australia, particularly in Melbourne. So you see that Little Bourke Street here, strong Chinese community. But there's other little ethnic enclaves all around Melbourne, and you see the same thing in Sydney and the other capital cities. And this is great. The food. Australia, in my opinion, would have been a culinary wasteland prior to the influx of migrants after the Second World War. This dish here is a Korean dish called bibimbap, which is one of my favourites and staples. Cricket, although this comes from a British tradition, right now this is a great vehicle for interaction between Australia and India, and you see a lot of Australian cricketers going to work in India in the Indian Premier League 2020 competition. And of course everyone's familiar with K-pop and Psy and Gangnam Style. Can anyone do the dance?
My 4-year-old, 7-year-old and 10-year-old.
Yeah, I have done it in a lecture before, but I'm not going to do it today. So, cultural ties are extensive and very strong, and something that can be built upon by the fact that numerous people from other countries have come to live here, so it's inevitable that those ties will exist. Those people-to-people ties can then develop into institutional ties. So Australia is very active at the moment, as the Australian government, in cultivating diplomatic and strategic ties with countries in the region. So do you know who any of these guys are on the screen? We know who K-Rudd is. Now, it's just a trick of photography that he sits in the middle of this picture because he wouldn't have been in the actual lineup. Who's the guy to K-Rudd's right? It's Manmohan Singh. He's the Prime Minister of India. Next to him is Im Jong-bak, who was the Korean president until late last year. And I don't know who some of the other guys are. But this is at the ASEAN East Asia Summit. Now, there's a whole host of different international institutions that Australia's trying to get involved in so it can integrate, firstly, economically into the region. But also, because Australia is geographically located in region, it has lots of strategic strategic reasons to have good relationships with countries in the area. So Indonesia, why might we want good relations with Indonesia? Yeah, that's exactly right. So if you look at the map, Indonesian archipelago is the only place that could be an invasion corridor. It's the place where human security issues, like people smuggling, like drug trafficking, like terrorism, things of governance problems in Indonesia can express themselves as issues that affect Australia. So Australia has a great interest in the stability of the Indonesian state for security reasons. But also with trade links. Now, four out of Australia's top five trade partners are located in Asia. So that's China, South Korea and Japan. United States is in there as well. So why? What's our trade links with China? What are we selling them?
Iron.
Yeah, what else? Anything that anything we can dig out of the ground, we're selling them. And China is such an enormous market for those kind of primary products because China is now the engine of the global economy. And when you've got such a large country whose economy is expanding at 7 or 8% per year, they have an enormous thirst and requirement for natural resources so that they can run their economy.
Where's Indonesia on there?
Indonesia's not a big trade partner, interestingly.
Why is that?
Well, they don't need our resources because they're still in large part a developing country, and they've got lots of natural resources of their own, so they don't need to buy them off us. And they don't make a lot of manufactured goods that get exported here. I mean, there's some trade. Most of the economic links are Australian companies investing in facilities in Indonesia, and there's a lot of aid and concessional trade links. Australia's
the beef industry and all that sort of stuff.
That'd probably be one of our biggest export.
That's all you hear about the news.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they don't really need to buy anything from us apart from that. So that's a good point you've raised. Japan, this is a country, a small island country, doesn't have much in the way of its own natural resources. Huge economy, so of course they're going to be big buyers of what comes out of the ground in Australia too. And coming back the other way, these enormous economies that make all kinds of manufactured goods, Australia is a market for the sale of those goods. So we bring in a lot of products that are made in the Asian region. In terms of security, that also means because Australia's economy is so dependent on exporting goods to Asia and then importing goods from Asia, is that if there's any security problems or international crises that would block the flow of that trade in the form of a war in the South China Sea, for example, then that would have an enormous impact on the Australian economy, which is why Australia gets involved with these international forums in the region to try and make sure that collectively security can be maintained to keep these economic links going for everyone's benefit. Travel. Australians are known as great travellers. The cliche is that you finish high school or uni and then you jet off to London and work for a couple of years. Has anyone done that? Ho-hum yawn. I think that's so cliche. Go to Asia. It's interesting. It's difficult. It's cheap. So this is where the action is in international affairs. So this is a great place to go to. And a lot of people do. So these people-to-people links, Australians going to countries in the Asian region, and people from this region coming to visit us here in Australia. So these people-to-people links are very strong. And because of its proximity, it's easy to get to, unlike everywhere else in the world, which is very difficult to get to from Australia, costly and time-consuming. Who here has been to a country in Asia, excluding Bali? Yeah. And where have you been?
Japan and Indonesia.
Yeah?
Sri Lanka, Cambodia, Thailand.
Oh, fascinating. Guys up here?
Vietnam, Cambodia.
Yep.
China, India.
Yeah, fantastic.
Thailand, Indonesia, Cambodia, well, it's the Pacific Islands, which are classified as out of Asia now as well.
Yeah, if you use the Asia-Pacific designation, yeah. Mm, absolutely. So good, there's a lot of travel experience in that region. Do you feel like having gone to these places that you're a bit more wiser about what these regions are about? Yeah, good. So that's the kind of experience when you come back, consciously or not, you're sharing this knowledge and understanding with the people around you. Which is your social act is in the process of improving Australia's net understanding of the region that it sits in. Also, the previous government released a white paper called Australia in the Asian Century, which was really emphasising that because Australia's economic fortunes are so invested in this region, that the government should really prioritise capitalising on this relationship by getting Australia to mobilise its educational capacity towards better understanding of the region, which will then facilitate more intense relationships through that understanding. Has anyone read this paper or sections of it? Now, Martha, you've got this on the reading list, have you?
Yes, it's actually uploaded. And they've got, you know, the website link for the Asia Foundation.
Yeah, so have a look at this. And also there's a organisation here in Melbourne called the Asia Education Foundation, which I'm a member of. I'm an Asia Literacy Ambassador, so from time to time I go out to high schools and have talks like this, which is great fun. And it's part of this broader strategy by the government to try and increase Australia's Asia literacy, because it's hard to integrate into a region when you've got this burden of history and when understanding of Asian cultures is still relatively raw among a large slab of the Australian population. So one way or another, you're going to be, in your professional capacities, are going to become part of this process. So with that in mind, have another quick chat with your buddies around you about how these economic connections, cultural connections, political connections are of professional interest to you personally. Okay. Any thoughts? Yep. Yeah, so how might that express itself?
Well, I guess in talking about things like the Asian Century white paper, there's a lot of comparison to how people learn in countries like Korea, China, and I guess productivity.
Mm-hmm. So what are some of those differences in the way people learn, particularly in Confucian societies like those?
I don't actually know specifically, but I guess there's differences in terms of how classrooms are set up in terms of student-teacher dynamics and school days, school organisation.
Yeah, that's a great point you raise. And for example, this kind of dynamic wouldn't be happening in a Chinese classroom, because these are Confucian societies where the teacher is venerated as the fount of wisdom. So I would be losing face if I asked the students a question for their opinion. I should be standing up here and telling the students how it is. And part of that learning model is also a lot of rote learning. So the type of thing that you would do in high school, in preparation for a high school maths exam, that's how you learn for your entire study. Which for young people, when they come out of that environment and come into an environment like this one here, where it's a lot more interactive, where there's a lot more interpretive skills required, a lot more analytical and critical thinking faculties required, that say they sometimes struggle. So this is something that you'll probably notice in your teaching practice at one point or another. Any other thoughts? Yeah?
My experience in high school was very like Eurocentric history. I think
we're
going to have to integrate a lot more about how Asian countries have come to this point now and what's come before so that people can understand contemporary context.
Yeah, that's true. And if you look at popularity of history curricula in the VCE, it's still very heavily weighted towards European history, which is a problem when Asia is where the action is in terms of the global economy and global politics. So it's quite a big cultural shift that's required here in Australia to bring about the objectives of the Australia in the Asian Century white paper. Mm. So you'll be at the vanguard of that. Good luck.
on that, I think it's also to do with like cultural capital, what Australians value is as rich culture, and I think China specifically, you know, we sort of undervalue the rich histories that those nations have.
Yeah, I've got a graphic which I regret not putting in this slideshow, which it shows the dynastic succession on a bar graph in China. So you've got political history unbroken for 4,000 years. And then at the bottom is Australia's 200 years of history, which takes up a tiny portion of the graph. So it really, it puts us in a perspective, and it shows that some of the cultural chauvinism that exists here is really not warranted. Any other thoughts? Okay, let's move on now to the personal development angle. So what attributes you'll get out of this kind of cross-cultural learning for your own personal development? Does anyone know what these are? Close. My son calls his a tail, although that's not its technical name. These are deer penises. This is a picture that I took, I think it was in Harbin in northeast China a few years ago. And this is in a Chinese medicine shop. Now, why might I put pictures of deer cocks on a slideshow? Again, the heading is a clue. It's about cultural knowledge. To understand the context of this picture requires, you know, a reasonably sophisticated understanding of Chinese history and culture to understand what this graphic's about and why this particular product is being sold in a shop to everyday punters. So this is just a tiny example of the fact that learning about other cultures expands your knowledge base, and when you get in situations of cross-cultural interaction, if you have a deeper knowledge of the cultures of the people that you're interacting with, then you're less likely to make a faux pas, and you're more likely to come out with something that's mutually constructive. Next point is self-awareness. Now, this is a picture of me singing karaoke in a city called Dandong, which is on the, in China, but on the Yalu River, which is the border between China and North Korea. And this is one of my students, a guy called Tony, who periodically would trade in North Korea as a businessman. Now, self-awareness is really important. So all the stuff I talked about at the start of the lecture, if you're not aware of the history and rich context of your own culture, it's really hard to interact with people from other cultures. But also, it's like a symbiotic circle. The more you learn about other cultures, it gives you a basis for comparison to come to a better understanding of your own culture. So it's a really interesting two-way process here. And I also became aware in this interaction that my watermelon red shirt was really not a winner. So that one's gone to St. Vincent de Paul. Another thing you'll learn is cross-cultural consciousness. So this was a wonderful man who ran a little bookshop in Goa, India, which I went to, and he gave me a copy of the Bhagavad Gita, which was probably the most valuable book in his store, and this was a wonderful interaction I had. And through that interaction, I got one of the seminal texts of Indian literature and learnt a lot more about that culture through that understanding. Now, who here, when they've travelled, has found themselves in a tricky situation? Yeah, you can't go overseas and not find yourself in a tough spot from time to time. That kind of experience, you don't just sit there and weep and wallow and fill yourself with self-pity. You're in a foreign land, you just got to deal with that situation, which helps you develop better adaptive skills. And likewise, you don't have to find yourself overseas to have that kind of experience. Teaching, you'll endlessly find yourself in situations where you have to adapt, where something that you try doesn't work, and you have to, on the hop, attempt something different. So, Martha, you would agree with that, I'm sure. Yeah. So doing this in the context of cross-cultural learning presents endless opportunities where you have to adapt and try something different, which is a great skill to learn for every facet of your life. But particularly as teachers, learning to be adaptable as a teacher is one of the most critical skills that you'll develop in your professional capacity. Cross-cultural learning is also great for developing your analytical and communication skills. So to learn about other cultures necessarily means that you have to analyse and critique what those cultures are about. And then learning another language also is a great example of learning how to communicate better. Now, who here has been in a situation where they've been in another country or talking to someone from another culture here where there's a language barrier? So how do you deal with that, speaking of adaptation? How do you communicate something when it's not... Yeah. Yes, in the age of iPhone, that's helpful. But I remember an age before mobile phones. It was a wonderful age where people couldn't connect with me 24/7. Body language was the key there. Facial expression, drawing pictures, anything that you can use to communicate that. So learning to be a holistic communicator, using every trick in your armory in order to get your point across, is something you learn through learning another language. And also learning another language engages a whole lot of other thinking faculties that you don't otherwise engage in other types of learning. So it's a fantastic skill to have. So with all that in mind, how might these skills make you a better teacher? Now, I threw you a bone with adaptivity, but what about the other ones? So have a chat briefly with your partners and then we'll talk again. Okay. Who wants to share?
We said that you become a better role model and students emulate your behaviours and what you value.
Yeah, and I bet everyone here remembers a favourite teacher or two from their educational experience. They're role models for what you're about as teachers today. So, yeah, people are always watching what you're doing, particularly your students. Any other thoughts?
It makes the learning process more of an exchange if you're willing to interact with students who are from a range of different backgrounds.
Mm.
You can be self-aware and culturally aware enough to try and take something from them, then you're not pushing one idea down.
Yeah, and you, as a teacher, you can learn so much from your students, and being aware of your own limitations and being willing to engage with that is really important. So one of the reasons I come in to speak to a group like you guys, a totally different student group to what I'm usually exposed to, and I can get a lot, just as much out of this exchange as you can from listening to me. Anything else?
I said sort of like improvisation skills.
Mm, mm.
So like even with stuff like when kids ask you a question that be quite difficult to answer in regards to even appropriateness or religion, stuff that you don't really want to, you know, being put on the spot, you know, in different countries helps you, I don't know, cope and being able to deal with that a little bit more. As well as like communication skills in general. Like I babysit quite a few kids that have got speech difficulties, and I find that helps me a lot better trying to understand more body language than words, or even trying to like use different words, you know, like to try and understand or.
Yeah, saying the same thing 5 or 6 times in a different way until it registers.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's right, that's great. Anything else? Okay, that's the conclusion of my presentation. I hope you found it helpful and useful.
Yes, Ben, can I just ask you a question? And this is at a political level.
Mm.
now that we've got the Abbott government, obviously we know it's going to be a Conservative government. I'm not so sure whether I heard it right this morning. I think he is going to meddle with the national curriculum in terms of the teaching of some of the Asian languages. And it would be a shame to take this country backwards, really.
Well, this is what you'll see. Whoever's in, there's always a culture war going on. Your history teacher's up there. This is very pertinent to you. Conservatives, political conservatives, tend to have a very different interpretation about how history should be taught and what history should be taught to people of a more progressive bent. So policy related to education is always caught in this tension between conservatives and progressives. And this is something that you'll inevitably deal with in your professional practice. And just quickly, these are my contact details. I'm always available to take questions, or if you need some documents on something to do with Asian countries or whatever, please get in touch. I maintain a Facebook and Twitter feed. It's not my personal Facebook account, it's a page, where I share lots of articles and information and so on and so forth. I'm also recording this presentation to put on my blog, which is up there, and I'll put this PowerPoint up there as well, and I think you'll have it on LMS. Yeah, so this will be available for you to look at in the future. So, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And thank you to you guys for participating. You've been great.
Thanks for sharing your wealth of knowledge and experience in the area, and I just hope that's just going to grow and grow and grow. And it's really a pleasure to have you at La Trobe University.
Thanks, Martha. Appreciate it.
It's a privilege.
Cheers.
Thanks. Okay, guys. Thanks a lot for tonight.